Okay, obviously the title Web 2.0 is a very sexy, attractive term, and a lot of people are interested in what this is all about, and in fact so am I, interested in finding out what Web 2.0 is all about. So what I want to talk about this evening is talk about some of the misconceptions, if you like, about Web 2.0, and also some of the dangers of Web 2.0, and some of the realities in where the direction should be going for this new type, if you like, of technology. Very briefly, I've got lots of slides to go through, so I'll quickly go through them. I work for NICTA, which is a national ICT Australia it's a research laboratory, obviously down under. We've got labs all over the major cities, and we're basically a full-time research institute. We're associated with four or five universities across Australia as well, and we do all sorts of research in various areas, from embedded systems to networks, complex systems, and managing data. And also, like most research laboratories, have a strong commercialisation effort. So that's all I'm going to say about NICTA. If you want to know more about NICTA, nicta.com.au, and you can read all about our projects. So what am I going to do today is talk about Web 2.0, what it is, aka what's the hype about it, what it should be, what's the reality. And then I'll talk about four particular areas I think the future holds: the policy-aware web, the semantic web, microformats and tags, interoperability, and hopefully I'll throw in a few web gems along the way as well. So let's get stuck into it. So what is Web 2.0? A very good question. Unfortunately, there's no short answer to it. We started off a few years ago at a conference given by O'Reilly, and they came up with this little map, if you like, of different functionality or aspects of Web 2.0. And there's lots of things here about different types of services up here, like your Flickers and your Googles, etc. And down here, different types of buzzword, if you like, about what Web 2.0 does, about it being a richer experience for people to use websites, etc. So there's lots of diagrams. There's another list of paradigm shift where we say, well, this, if we could number the web, but we really can't, Web 1.0 looked like this and Web 2.0 looks like that. So we went from double click to Google Ads. We went from Akamai to BitTorrent, etc. We went from page views to cost per click. We went from screen scraping to web services. We went from publishing to participation. We went from content to wikis, taxonomies to tagging, etc. Obviously it's unfair to say that we didn't have web services back here in Web 1.0 world. In fact, they've been around for quite a long time, and Wikipedia's been around for a long time as well. But I suppose what the idea is that they're trying to group together these new types of web services that enable groups of people to communicate more readily, more easily, and to share content, live, update, etc. And I suppose the other key thing is that there really isn't a 2.0 of anything, because there's no version of the web. So 2.0 is not a real version number in terms of your typical software version upgrades. It's just a way to refer to something that's new. So Wikipedia also has gone through, and obviously Wikipedia has been entered by lots of people, and they've come up with this long list of things that Web 2.0 covers. So richer internet experiences, more semantics, micro formats, folksomies, which is about tagging content, CSS, REST and XML, syndication, mashups, weblog publishing tools, wikis, OpenID, and open source software. Of course, all these have existed in some form or another previously, but putting them all together and this new effort to sort of bring together more readily available websites, more user interaction, is really about what Web 2.0 talks about. So there's other ways of showing this, and there's this nice little diagram here which sort of talks about some of the key parts of Web 2.0: participation, usability, simplicity, design, convergence, remixability, standardization, well, we'll talk about that in a moment, micro formats, and bringing together blogs, audio and video, wikis, etc., and social software and things like joy of use. These are the type of terms that aren't really technically definable, but when you look at it as a whole, is what the experience of WebPoint 2 is supposed to bring to everyone. So there's also been like organisations like InfoWeek who survey companies from a more of a corporate viewpoint and say, well, what are important tools for you from a corporate perspective? And here's a list they come up with, and social networks were right down here at 5%, and obviously collaborative content tools and wikis was one of their major ones. And then they come up with the an impact assessment with risks and benefits for these new technologies. And they actually talk about the bottom line, if you can, probably can't read this, but it says that Web 2 technology looks like a losing proposition for large organisations in general, which is an interesting outcome to come to announce. But I think it's more about your big companies with lots of legacy data, legacy systems. It will be much harder to incorporate Web 2.0. Then they talk about, well, in your new upcoming startup organisations, then it's more likely to utilise Web 2.0 technologies to enable you to run an organisation like you run a social network. So lots of different commentaries about the impact of WebPoint 2.0. But the question is, well, what is it really? It's probably what you're asking yourself. I really haven't answered the question. And I probably won't answer the question because there's no real answer. The only thing I can really say about what Web 2.0 is that it's basically a phenomenon. It's probably the best word to describe it. And my definition for that, taken from common sources, is it's an observable event of epic proportions. Now, I'm not talking about a major disaster, epic proportions, but you can actually see what's happening with Web 2.0. You can see the effect of it. You can sort of see these new websites and services being developed. And it's at quite significant proportions. You can see the many millions of people who join these social networks like your Facebooks, and the millions of people who are online on Skype at the one time. There's like 10 million people online at the same time. So it's epic in that sense. A lot of people are using these technologies. And obviously there's a reason for that, because it's actually providing them with some type of service that they that was missing before. And now these technologies are now providing that service to them. So a bit more specifically, I suppose in my own words, what Web 2.0 is. It's obviously about more user-centred services. And when I say user-centred, it's really about you as an individual being in control of your content. And in some cases with the social networks, with your friends, to be able to say, these are my friends, and I can share with those with that group information that I want to share with them, and only they can see it. It's about notification or syndication, but under my terms, from simple things for saying that I'm online to sharing the latest information about, here's my photos from my daughter's birthday party last week, those types of notifications. And obviously it's about very simple, very slick user interfaces. So the use of technologies like JavaScript and Flash and all those has really made the experience visually quite appealing. It's also about open services, enabling anyone to basically participate in these new social networks. Like, for example, adding your own widget, whatever a widget happens to be, which is some little software application that does something. You know, you can just add a widget that people have developed to your Facebook account, for example, and share some game, application or service. And it's very easy to do that. Anyone can do it. And of course, mashups has been around for quite a while, where you can take a bit of data from one site, add it to another, map it onto Google Maps, and bang, you have a new improved service. But it's also engaging, it's also a bit of fun, and for some people, it's also a bit, they want to be known out there. So it's an avenue for them to publicise their own special skills in certain ways. And we've seen that, you know, for YouTube, you can put up some really weird and wonderful videos, and some of them make it to the news on the 11 o'clock news, and others don't. Most of them don't, but every now and again you have some flash of someone who wants to be notorious on it. So, of course, like all technologies in the IT sector, lots of people want to be on the bandwagon. And, of course, Web 2.0 is no stranger to that. So there's lots of companies out there that claim to be Web 2.0. Here's a few of their logos. And, yes, I did copy and paste a lot of them. But there's actually a website out there, a Web 2.0 website, that collects Web 2.0 company logos and puts them all together. And there's about 10,000 of them or something. So as you can see there, lots of organisations are out there with some form of Web 2.0 solution technology. And of course, you know, and it continues on, you know, Web 2.0 expos. This is from the original people who came up with the term, O'Reilly's. They, of course, having expos all over the world. In fact, I think today's November 15th, isn't it? So they're doing it right now in Tokyo. They're having a Web 2.0 expo. And then, of course, it doesn't really stop there. You know, the others want to get in the act, so there's Enterprise 2.0. So, again, try and work out what that means. I don't know. But it's Enterprise 2.0. So you can go out there and buy Enterprise 2.0 technology. And then, of course, you can go out and get yourself a Security 3.0 solution as well. You know, so Gartner, you know, of course, being a big company in this sector, says, okay, you know, let's jump on the bad wagon, you know, Security 3.0. Ask them to define it. I don't think you get a very clear answer, but it's there. Of course, then you think, great, Security 3.0, but then again, people say, well, forget that. What about Security 4.0? What's that going to look like? Don't know. So as you see, there's lots of roll-on effect. Of course, it even gets even more interesting. I suppose it really made it in this world when the mass media pick it up. And of course, we had this one from Hollywood, Die Hard 4.0. Also came out. So you can see where it continues on and on and on.
It's abstract, actually.
Yes. Yes, please.
Can I ask a question about definitely, I know I can't get a very clear definition of Web 2.0. But the other question I want to ask is, this is a fact or fiction? Or still undergoing the evolution of Web 2.0? Let me start thinking of something else. A few years ago, when Microsoft, they launched a .NET, in the first place, it was very unclear, abstract. Even Microsoft people can't tell you what .NET was about. But after a few years, clearly, we found a track. Yep. We know the direction. Is it something similar to that?
No, I don't think it is similar to something like a .NET, because it's not a...
I'm not talking about the technology.
Yeah.
It's like an evolution process.
It's definitely an evolution process, and I'll have a couple of slides in a moment to show you where it could be going as well. But yeah, it's not a very clear-cut thing where you can say this is exactly what 2.0 is, this is what 3.0 is, etc., etc. So it's more of a mindset about how things go. So, you know, so we're talking about Web 2.0, you know, and then people are now talking about Web 3.0. And on Wikipedia, you can also find out what Web 3.0 is. And it has all these other terms about Web 3.0. You know, it's, you know, network computing, it's software as a service, it's open technology, open eyes, open soul software, it's about open identity, it's about the semantic web, it's about distributed databases, it's turning the World Wide Web into the World Wide Database, it's about intelligent applications, about natural language processing. So it's all about all these converging together. So all these are technologies that have been around for a long time, and now what we're saying is that they're finally getting to a stage where we can actually bring them together and provide the vision that the IT sector had decades ago about using computers to help the human, as opposed to just letting computers process numbers all day and crunch away. So these are some of the buzzwords that 3.0 is about. But of course, this is on Wikipedia, so you tonight can go back home and you can add your own to it. If you come up with your own technology, go to Wikipedia and edit it, because that's part of Web 2.0. You can edit this if you want and add your own technology. So where is it heading? You know, some people have been... This is another report where it talks about the evolution of the web from version 1, if you like, which is just connecting information. And then we move across to the social web here, which is where we are with 2.0, where we're more connecting people together. Up at Web 3.0, it's more about the semantic web, where it's connecting knowledge together. And over here in 4 is the ubiquitous web, which is about connecting intelligence, according to this diagram, where basically everything comes together, both the intelligence from the semantic web and the people being connected here all together in one framework there. Again, what that really means in reality, there's no definitive versions for these 4 boxes. So it's never clear when you're in one state or the other. It's just a matter of you evolve between these, and sometimes you'll be over here in the social web when you're doing more social things, and if you're in the semantic web, you'll be still up here. And of course, in the future, you'll be able to merge those together. So that little diagram came from this report here. Are you ready for the semantic wave? And of course, if you're ready for it, you can sort of get ready, and if you pay $3,000, you'll get a copy of the report that tells you about what the semantic wave is and Web 2.0 is. So you can pay some money, and these people will tell you what Web 2.0 is. Not too convinced that they will, but yes, Angela.
Renata, Tim Berners-Lee was very much connected with the semantic web.
Yes.
And you are a member, used to be a member of WCG.
Still are, yeah, we're back in, yes.
So what is his latest thinking or pronouncement on this development?
Well, Tim Berners-Lee did definitely say in the press that he did not like the term Web 2.0 at all, but of course it's too late. You know, it's too late whether you like it or not, it's here. So he was never a fan of the word. So I think he's also very interested in seeing where it goes, because this is taking the web to a new direction, so it's very important for W3C. He's also said that the semantic web is probably not the right term as well for what they're doing at the moment. It's still more about getting data to interoperate more and more than semantics, because semantics is a really powerful term if you can do the semantic web, because it really means that you understand everything, and computers understand everything, and that's a very bold claim to make. But yeah, so Tim has sort of come out and in the press and said didn't like the term too well. But so in essence, gem number one is don't really worry about what the web is 2.0 is, because you could spend lots of time, you could spend $3,000, but you wouldn't be any better off. Trust me, you give me half that and I can tell you what it is. However, what you should do is worry when things go wrong. That's what you should worry about. So I'm going to tell you about some things that can go wrong. So this is the front page of The Economist recently. Who's afraid of Google? Because Google, Microsoft probably, yes. But Google is becoming a very, very big company. And things to do with privacy, in what they're doing with China, antitrust, copyright, they're becoming very powerful in their ability to reach in and control what happens. Give an example. On Flickr, Chewy Wong uploaded some photographs that he took of some friends on Flickr, like many millions of other people do. So here's some photographs that Chewy Wong uploaded to Flickr. Yeah, you can look at them, lovely, all look great. One day, disappeared on a bus stop. It's an ad from Virgin Mobile. Okay? It's on a bus stop in Adelaide, I think. This photograph here was taken from Flickr. And the person, the subject says, hang on, that's me in that photograph. I had no idea they used me on this national ad for Virgin mobile phones. So there's a big discussion from this person here saying, hang on, how can this happen? How can my photograph of me appear in a national ad without me even knowing about it? And if you read through it here, basically it was allowable because the person, Chewy, who uploaded the photographs, actually, if you read the fine print, which you can't down here, actually did follow all the rules, which was he allowed those photographs to be reused as long as you attributed the use of the photograph. And this is exactly what Virgin did. They attributed this photograph comes from Flickr with the URL. So they followed all the guidelines. But of course, the person who was in the photograph wasn't very happy about them. So in Flickr, you can use Creative Commons for selecting your license terms. It's not the default thing, but you can go in and specify more details about what your license conditions are. And this person had actually selected the ability to, you can reuse as long as you attribute the photograph. Of course, now they won't be happy about that and are now trying to sue Creative Commons. Not Flickr, but Creative Commons, because they were misleading them about what the rights were in this in these licenses. But in fact, they probably don't have a case to argue, so they probably won't win that at all. In Australia recently, we had a terrible incident where one of our soldiers was killed in Afghanistan. And on the front page of all the major media, like the Sydney Morning Herald, there's all these photographs, of course, of the person, unfortunately, who had passed away in this war, and talked about how this person was using Facebook, was a loving husband, was talking about how he and his wife had been prolific users of Facebook, etc., etc. Unfortunately, what they didn't realise was that they had put out the family had requested that their privacy be respected, which you would normally expect during such an incident. But of course, the media didn't agree with that, and they basically just went off and said, "We're going to take all these Facebook photos that you upload on the Facebook, and we're going to plaster them across the media in Australia." So they did that. So then when they were put the task, and the ABC has a little weekly show where they asked these organisations like the Sydney Morning Herald, "Did you know that these photographs were personal photographs and you didn't actually have, technically you did not have the republication rights for it?" And then some of their responses were quite interesting. So here is the ABC. That they believe that the material was published publicly and there was no reason for them to get permission or wasn't even relevant. In the Sydney Morning Herald, it's a big long response they said, but the key thing they said in here, which is interesting, is that they don't believe that they were at fault. They said that technology has brought many benefits to society, but it's also had an impact on both the concept and reality of privacy. So the technology has changed the idea of what privacy is. So he's saying that Trooper Pierce's Facebook account was a public document, and anyone who subscribed to Facebook has complete rights to access those photographs and any other bit of information and do whatever they like with it. Of course, that's not true. And there are laws that protect you as the owner of an image, for example, that you are the copyright owner and you have exclusive rights, which means no one else can republish those. But they, as you can see here, the public media here is saying that technology has changed the idea of privacy. So, worry about what Web 2.0 does is probably the key thing, gem number two. So, there are three things I think that are pretty key what to worry about, and they are rights, which you've just seen, privacy, which you've just seen, and of course identity, who you are. So these three together is what we term policy interaction. The three different types of policies, a rights policy, an identity policy, and a privacy policy. And somehow they need to interact and be well known by both the owner of the content as well as the end user of the content. And the moment we don't do this very well in terms of technologies to support how policies are expressed and how they are honoured and tracked and made accountable on the internet and the web. So what we're moving towards is called the policy-aware web. So this is a bit of the research that we're doing at NICTA about how can we actually get to the point where we can have policies in the web and actually have them supported by the infrastructure. So that those two use cases I just showed you may not happen in the future. There's no guarantees, of course, but it may not happen. So this is something that Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web, has sort of come out and said this is a new way of providing technologies for the web, and it could hold the key for providing more open distributed web services. So there's policies everywhere. So as I mentioned three: privacy, rights, identity. There's also context, enterprise policies. There's web services policies. There's security policies. There's a lot of languages out there for policies. And what we're trying to do is, traditionally now, if you wanted to build a service that supported privacy, rights, and identity, you'd have to use three different technologies. And that's a very difficult thing to maintain and to manage across the internet. So what we want to do is take have a framework for these policies, move it into the infrastructure of the web so that we can actually have policies interact with themselves. So if there's a conflict between a privacy policy and a rights policy, then we can detect that if there's a conflict. If you've got a privacy policy that says, I don't want my photos to be on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald, and the Sydney Morning Herald editor logs in, that person should be aware of that. And that's where we need to be taking those first steps in awareness of the policies. So at the moment there are, as I mentioned, policies being used. Creative Commons is a good example of a rights policy. It's a very simple rights policy. It's just basically an identifier that says, here is a license to use my content. And there's a few terms about you should attribute it, etc., etc. There's no enforcement of the policy. It's just a statement that you make. So the end user has to be aware of it. Are we all familiar with iTunes? They actually have a policy in the for your music. It's a very simple one, which basically means if you buy music from iTunes, you can only copy it to 4 other devices. So there's a very simple policy, and that's enforced because Apple owns all the infrastructure. So if you own the infrastructure, you can enforce a policy, like Apple does. If you don't own the infrastructure, you can't enforce a policy, like Creative Commons. In the mobile world, there's a lot of digital rights management technology being developed in the mobile world. Again, the reason for that is the mobile carriers own a lot of the infrastructure, so they can actually enforce rights management. So it's much harder to do that in the internet. Identity is another major problem. I must have something like 200 different identities on different websites that I've created over the past decade. And of course, that's an absolute nightmare to maintain 200 different identities, 200 different accounts, 200 different passwords. Actually, I have software that manages all of them. I'm sure many of you have a similar problem. OpenID is an example of trying to break through that and actually have a single identity for people that they can reuse across any website. So if you go to if you go to your favourite Web 2.0 website, you can log in with that single identity, and then if you go to another one, you can use the same identity. And OpenID is the infrastructure for doing that. It hasn't taken off a lot at the moment, but it's slowly making its way into the common infrastructure. So it does rely on you trusting another third party, though, having your identity. So this is my OpenID account. And I've trusted a third party to actually be almost like my identity proxy. But the nice thing is that once I register my OpenID, I have a unique name then, which I can then log in on any site that supports OpenID. And then when you log into that site, they then talk to my trusted third party and say, hey, would you allow Renato to log into this site? And I can do things like, sure, and I trust the site forever, or only once, or I'll expire it in a couple of days. So I can do these nice little cute things that if I'm not really sure about this other side, I'll let them use it once when I log in. But if I trust them, like my bank, I'll say, sure, always trust this site. So that way I can have single identity, which is a great new feature of the new Web 2.0 sites. And of course, privacy isn't really well supported from an infrastructure point of view. So you can do privacy in your favourite browser, things like to do with cookies, accepting cookies or not. Not anything more detailed than that. So privacy is still application specific. And Facebook, of course, is a good example. We've seen through this. And I think it's going to get probably worse before it gets any better. So Facebook is now talking about tailoring ads to their users. So they'll get people coming in and actually paying money to be an advertiser in Facebook, and then they'll target individuals based on your profile for adverts. So Facebook will also give these marketeers aggregated data about your age, sex, hobbies, and anything else you write in your Facebook account. And they also track what you talk about products. If in your Facebook you say, I don't like Coca-Cola, they'll track that, and they may do something with it, but you don't know what. So it's becoming a bit of a scary situation. However, Facebook does allow you to have very good privacy in terms of sharing information amongst your selected group of friends. So your profile, and there's my profile there, and they even nicely do things like they blur out the photographs of my friends so you can't see them. So it's a very cute thing to do, but very important. So here's my profile, and there's my lovely face up there and everything else. And you can do things like just select which parts of my profile I want to share to other people, whether it's the world, or whether it's my group of friends, or who, what feeds I want to send, or what photo albums that I upload that I'm happy to share with others or don't want to share with others. So I can just select them one by one. So they've thought about it. So from an application point of view, they've done quite a good job in protecting your privacy to some extent. But of course, you as a user, if I let the whole world access this, then it doesn't stop someone downloading those photographs and doing something with it, like we saw in the Trooper case.
Do you think it was because they forgot to do it, or they didn't know they could do it?
I suspect they really weren't sure what they were doing, because when you subscribe to join Facebook, you have to make a choice whether you want your stuff to be public or only to your friends. And most cases, people think, well, it's probably just let them make it public because it's easier. And so that if once you do that, of course, it is public, but it still doesn't mean you're giving away your rights. So that's the difference. So you can still make all your stuff public on Facebook, but technically you still own all that content. The Sydney Morning Herald can't take your photographs and put them on the front page without seeking your permission, which is a typical thing that normally happen. And of course, it continues on. This is in the last week's Times. So Facebook now allowing corporations to advertise via users, which means that your friends on Facebook will now email you and contact you and say, hey, have you ever tried Coca-Cola? Because Coca-Cola asked them to do that. So it's getting even more interesting where they're going to use your friends to do viral marketing. So again, maybe one of the checkboxes on my profile should be, I don't want my friends selling me anything. Of course, I could add that, but then I've got to go and update my profile. So the interesting thing, though, that when you talk about policies, or the privacy rights or identity, is that when you start to talk in detail about what is a privacy policy, it actually intensifies people's concerns, because once you start to codify what is privacy, what is rights, people start to think, well, you know, what does this really mean? How does it impact me? So one of the things to do is we need to sort of totally redesign the way we do policy management. And policies are very complex. This is a very simple policy. This is P3P policy, which is a privacy policy from W3C. This is an identity policy, which is Xactmo, another technology for identity. And this is a rights policy, ODRL. So complex diagrams, and if you're an engineer, you can look at them and decide, blah, 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 what's related to what. But in essence, they're quite complex, particularly for the end user. So we need to have a better model, and this is some of the stuff that we've been doing about how to have a much simpler model for a policy. I won't go into detail because it's a lot of research, techno, jumbo going on here, but in essence, you want to be able to express policies in terms of people, what can people do, over what resource and what actions we allow. That's the basic idea behind a common policy. And there's also some extra stuff in the middle there. Again, I won't go into too much detail, but of course in some cases you want to have a bit more specific stuff about constraints and content and obligations. So you may say that, you know, Joe can see my photograph to print it out, but it's only constrained for 1 week. Now, something like that if you really want to get into details. So the good thing is that W3C has recognised this and has now started a policy language interest group. So this is now bringing together all the different policy language groups and say, hang on, let's get together, discuss about how we can move towards a single common policy framework. So we can manage identity, rights, privacy in Web 2.0. So the next tidbit is that Web 2.0 needs the policyware web. Whether it's called Web 2.0, we're not sure. It could be called 6.9 by then. But this new Web 2.0 definitely needs policy awareness. So, semantic web. Of course, semantic web has been around for a while. And it's bringing the web from its traditional structured view, which is just the XML, HTML view, right up to these new technologies, RDF and OWL, into the world of ontologies and more sophisticated information models. So it's really trying to bring a new knowledge representation to the web. That's the goal of the semantic web, and languages like OWL, for example, really get into heavy-duty knowledge representation, which is great, but it's very complex. And that's probably one of the reasons why we don't use a lot of semantic web technologies in our day-to-day use. So semantic web, this is the stack for semantic web from W3C, and we have your typical lower layer stuff here, but semantic web basically starts from here, from the RDF stuff, and moves all its way up to here, and then this stuff up here as well. We're not too sure what that means. But we also want to be able to add into it the policy-aware web as well as part of the infrastructure. So when we talk about the policy-aware web, we want to be able to put the semantics of policies inside the web infrastructure, so that we can be aware of how to describe a policy in RDF, how to prove that the policy is true, and how to trust the person who said the following things. Of course, this is a real long way up, this stuff up here. This proof and trust stuff is a long way away, but that's where we're heading. So the semantic web is quite interesting. Because I could give a whole talk about the semantic web as well, but I won't. Because there's a lot of interest in semantic web and about what it can do, what it can provide you. But it's still yet to prove itself. It's still yet to come up with that killer application that the end user, your typical user, says, yay, that's great, that's brilliant, I love it. So it really has a long, long way to go. So basically the semantic web actually needs to address the problems in Web 2.0, not the other way around. It needs to look back and say, here's Web 2.0 and it's trying to do the following things. How can the semantic web help it? How can we get our technologies to help the Web 2.0? So that's what we need to do. Because otherwise, these new technologies like micro formats and tags are basically going to overtake it. So, what's a micro format? Well, a micro format, in some sense, is just a small bit of information that's marked up in a structured way so that you can actually provide some value-added service to it. So here's an example of if you just look up here, of a little dialog box that allows you to specify a friend of yours and how you're related to that friend. And this is obviously very useful in social networks like Facebook, because Facebook, a friend invites you, you then go through this process of working out how you know this friend. Is it an acquaintance? Did you go to school with him or her, etc.? And so in here, the same thing. You can specify your friend, their URI, how do you know them, have you met, is it a co-worker, is it a family member, blah, blah, blah. And then you can construct the link. And what you get at the end of this is this little bit of code here. Probably can't read it, but it's a bit of HTML code. And this is a micro format. Also because it's quite small as well on the screen. And it basically says that embedded in this HTML tag is all the information I put up in here. The fact that I know this person and their URI, and I relate to them via they're a co-worker, they're a neighbour, they're a spouse, and they're a sweetheart. Probably not in that order. And then what I do is I put this into my Facebook account, into my web page. So the information is actually part of the web page. So once you start using micro formats and they start appearing in web pages, then interesting things can happen. So this is my online CV. In Firefox, you can get a little plugin that detects micro formats. So in my page here, I've actually created micro formats for my name and address and phone numbers and nationality here. So even though this looks like a web page, underneath the actual HTML code, there's all these little micro formats in there. So you can't actually see, all you see is a user view with a web page, great. But what you can see in Firefox is a little contacts appears up here, and I've got two of the plugins, there's another little green one down here that appears. What it tells me is, hey, there's some micro formats in this page, do you want to look at them? And I say yes, And basically it tells me that Renato has a contact information, so I can export all this information into my favourite, you know, address book, for example. And all the structured information here will come across straight away. Another way of looking at that is down the bottom here, when you click on that, it says it's found an object called Renato Yanella, and the structure I've found in this particular micro format is, you know, the full name, his street address, his city, etc., etc. So that's all embedded in a structured way we can get access to. And there's no semantic web there. There's no RDF, there's no OWL, there's nothing. It's just pure, straightforward, very simple HTML tags. And it works. It's a very simple way. It's very easy to understand. So that really is a threat, I suppose, to the semantic web. It's if this becomes the de facto way of describing information in the Web 2.0 world, then the Web 2.0 world will say, well, why do we need the semantic web? What's the real, real benefit? There probably is some very narrow business benefit for it, but for your typical user, this will probably suffice. So tagging is another way that's very becoming very popular. It's interesting because it's probably a new name for metadata, which we used a decade ago, but now the term is called tags. So tags are just simply keywords that you type in to describe something. And on Flickr here, I've just found this picture that someone posted about Hong Kong University on Flickr. And you see, notice over here, there's a tag section, and you can type in whatever you like. So this person's typing Hong Kong University, and universities. So that just makes it a bit easier for people to find that site. So if you're looking for Hong Kong University, you can search based on that. And of course, it's much easier to do that because it's very hard to index this image and to find out that it's Hong Kong University. I'm sure some researcher has done that, but the end user, it's much easier simply to type in the words. So the question now is, with these new technologies, could this become a semantic web killer? Probably not. It probably just wounded it just a little bit. So, but the message there is that these technologies, although they are very powerful, they really need to turn back and address what the Web 2.0 world is doing. So my final point is about interoperability. And this is another tough one to crack. So on the social web, I've got an account on Flickr for my high school photographs, which we did at a reunion a few years ago. I've got a Google Groups account for our alumni. I've got a LinkedIn account for my professional contacts and colleagues. I've got a Facebook account for friends and colleagues. I've got a Friends United account for schoolmates. And that's when I stopped. I could go on, I could go off and create myself an account in MySpace, etc., etc., etc. But I decided I've had enough. The problem here, of course, is that on all that information that I've been capturing and putting together, it overlays a lot of these, particularly things like LinkedIn. It's almost like a Facebook, but just for my professional colleagues. Even though my professional colleagues now want me to join them as friends on Facebook. So I'm having to repeat the same information over and over again, maintaining all the time, and it's really getting quite annoying. And of course, it gets even worse. So the problem is that across all these sites, there's actually zero interoperability between the sites. And there's obvious reasons for that. Facebook wants you to stay in Facebook. LinkedIn wants you to stay in LinkedIn. They don't want you... I mean, the ideal scenario is that someone sends me a Facebook request saying, hey, I want to join as your friend. And I say, not a problem, but I'm over in LinkedIn. Join me over there. And it all works. But that's not what happens today. So when I talk about interoperability, I want to be able to choose where my favourite social network is, and I want to stay there. And I want everyone else to come to me. So if someone sends me a request to join MySpace, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to have to repeat all the stuff again. I'm going to have to import all my friends again. I'm not going to do that. So I want the Web 2.0 to allow me to choose where I want to be, and then everyone else come to me. That's what I want to do. So there's been attempts to solve this. Google have developed something called Open Social, but it's more of an API. And the reason they developed is that they want to make it easier for people to develop social network sites. So it's more about the developer creating the software to run a social network site. Of course, as soon as that happened, lots of people jumped in, and MySpace said, yeah, we're going to join the Google Alliance because we hate Facebook too. They all want to kill Facebook. And of course, Facebook has now been slightly bought out by 1 or 2% by Microsoft. And then, of course, Oracle jumped in as well. Yeah, we want to be part of Open Social as well. But there's also some problems in there. So there are lots of holes in this API. So it's still not... The key point here is that Open Social is still not an open standard. It's still proprietary, defined by Google. So it gets back to that The Economist front page. Do you trust Google? Who knows? So the problem is that Web 2.0 needs open interoperability. It definitely needs that, and we don't have it today. But more specifically, not just open, it actually needs information interoperability. So I'm concerned about the APIs, etc., but also I want my information to be interoperable as well. So I want to choose my best social network and get everyone else to share information with me at my social network. So, to wrap up, Web 2.0, the hype. Well, as I said, don't worry too much about what it is, but there is no new version. That's the first thing. 2.0 is a marketing term, it's not a software term. So there's no, you don't have to upgrade anything, you don't have to, change things. It's a new concept of more socially interactive websites, where you are in the power, you're sharing stuff. But of course, the reality is that you should worry about parts of Web 2.0, particularly parts where you're publishing information. So be careful what you publish. Even though you have rights protecting you, as we've already seen, you don't want to be in the front page of Sydney Morning Herald. So be careful what you do, or splash across by Virgin. But the reality is that it actually kicks out a lot more emphasis on the user, what they want to do. And it actually improved a lot of the websites, and they're thinking more about, well, this is what users want to do. And that's, I think, is a brilliant part of Web 2.0. But I think it's also where we now stand is that we can now drive, if you like, a new agenda for interoperability. Because interoperability on the web has been quite slow, I think, in terms of its takeoff. And it really hasn't had something to grasp onto and say, hey, let's focus on this as the application domain. And I think the social network is one that we can do it. So we can move towards more information interoperability and towards a policy awareness as well. So information, just simple things like microformats, are brilliant stuff. I only write my address once, and then everyone else knows about it. And the policy awareness is about getting the privacy and rights, etc., getting that right and getting that done correctly. And it is, my final thing is that it is a challenge to the semantic web diehards out there who believe that RDF and OWL are going to take over the world. I'm sorry, it's not going to, because this stuff here that's happening, this new Web 2.0, is really going to change the agenda. It's going to be a totally different world now. So with that... So we've gone from hype to reality, and we're going to go beyond. Where we head after that, we're not too sure, but it's certainly going to be an interesting journey for everyone involved. So thanks very much.